In fact, one of the reasons I got my timing all loused up today was that I was home lying in bed. I was reading from your new collection. I was reading over all of the biographical data that Janice sent, and I read the New Yorker story, and all of a sudden I looked at the clock, and I said, well, I have another hour before I have to leave, and all of a sudden I was jarred into shock, realizing that I was supposed to meet you in about 5 minutes. So it was fortuitous that you were late. Didn't make me look as bad.
Look, I don't even know that I'm late. I don't even look at my watch. I just follow her around.
That must be great, having an escort. Most of my guests, they have to...
It's like having a second brain.
Yeah, it must be wonderful.
Especially when you're absent-minded.
Yeah.
I mean, she yanks me back from walking in front of taxis and, you know, and things like that.
Yeah. Good thing she likes you.
She says she doesn't.
But most of my guests, they have to win their way to the facilities here on the subway all by themselves. But as I can tell, when an author has made it, when he has a publicity escort.
Don't be too sure. It may just have to do with the insurance policy.
they want you alive until they make back the advance on the book. Is that what you're saying?
It's a mixture of that, plus Janice's deep conviction, you know, shared by my wife, actually based on fact, that you can send me to the CBS radio station, but I won't get there without help.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. Are you really absent-minded?
Well, yeah, and then distractible, and you know, not necessarily. I mean, if there's a traffic jam in New York, I'll get stuck in it.
Don't we all?
I don't know. Janice doesn't seem to.
So she's had more experience escorting people around the traffic jams.
We got here about 80, what would you say, about 60 blocks? In about 3 minutes flat.
Must have had a heavy lunch today, huh?
No, the I'm not really sure for the reason for shelter, except that it really does cut down nervous tension. And don't think I've never done this stuff before.
What, publicity and stuff?
Yeah.
Well, luckily, a broadcast like mine is not live, and it's not on camera, and it's very difficult for one to embarrass him or herself on this broadcast, because the idea of this show is to salute the word and to salute the book and to salute the author, not to denigrate.
Well, no, but specifically here, for instance, look, let's say I had tried to do this, you know, we made a... You call Janice, then she called me, and I made an appointment to come in. Then you have to sign in downstairs, and you have to find your way upstairs. Well, actually, I did this with my wife's help at National Public Radio, and I only got lost twice. And part of that's because of stage fright. You know, and then after another, you know, 7 or 8 years of doing this, I'll just be as cool as you are.
Well, I'm not cool. It's a lot harder on me than it is on you. You're as I have learned, you are a cult figure, a man of mystery, and...
Well, that's easy compared to being on radio, not being a man of mystery anymore.
But don't you understand how intimidating you are to a reviewer like myself?
No. But if it's true, I mean, I'll be able to tell in a few minutes, and I'll start feeling better and better and better. I mean, you know, it's sort of an American thing. You know, social classes and ranks, you know, aren't very clear. And you don't know what's going to happen. And then you meet somebody, and then after about 4 or 5 minutes, they give you a certain amount of turf, or you've taken a certain amount of turf, and then things go on from there. But you don't know ahead of time. At least I don't know ahead of time. I don't think most, maybe women know, but I don't think men know ahead of time.
No, I think you're right. I remember I was doing an interview some years ago with Gore Vidal. I don't think Gore had any sleep the night before because he kept yawning through the interview. Also, I think he thought the broadcast was going to be more than it was. I think he expected a studio orchestra. I think he expected an Ed McMahon to do the introduction. You know, so there was just me and a technician. And so he was very intimidating. Not only did he keep yawning, he began to take over the show. And it reached the point where he was asking me questions, and he signed off the show for me.
Well,
you talk about intimidation.
Yeah, but he's had all that, you know, that movie experience. I mean, genuine political experience. Was his uncle or something, wasn't it? Was Speaker of the House of Representatives?
In fact, Gore Vidal ran for Congress from Dutchess County.
Yeah, well,
many years ago.
All that, I mean, I could see where that could be converted into rank, but all I've ever done is sit in a room and go, the letter I is over here, and the letter S is over here. You know what I mean?
Is that the way you do it?
No, not quite, but it's... I do know how to type. And if we were sitting in my house, I might not be as uncertain. Even I would be uncertain with somebody who is a journalist.
Well, I think it's not just the fact that I'm a journalist. I think when you meet a strange person, as you said a moment ago, you kind of have to feel your way. There's a certain...
Yeah, there are different kinds of strangeness. I mean, like with somebody homeless, where you have to do things for them. Or... say the friend of one of your kids or something like that, there are certain patterns that you start from and then you may work your way out of. With a journalist who knows what's going on in the country and who has a certain kind of experience in a field I don't have any experience in, it's more or less completely up in the air.
Well, you may be right. However, a writer such as yourself also writes from a certain journalistic sense, because you are as much as an observer of the world, of life, of passion, as any journalist is. So I would say we come off equally, and indeed I think it's probably more in your favor if one were to give odds.
Well, since you said these things, I mean, I'm willing to take the position since it's offered, but 2 days ago, the day before yesterday, I can't remember now, but I was in Washington, and I talked to a group of college kids, and I've taught college. So once the initial shyness is over, that's kind of my turf. I mean, I know what I'm doing. But again, radio and interviews and being brief and to the point and controlling your voice and, I don't know, all that stuff is new. And it'll be a while before I could, you know, pull a Gore Vidal. But if I could hear that tape, it might speed up the process.
Yeah. Yeah.
If I could see how he did it, I might be able to do it.
No, I erased that tape.
Uh-huh.
I didn't want that around. That was one of the few interviews I destroyed. It was too embarrassing. I was young, though. I was young, and I really was intimidated. But I know what you're saying. I have a book that's being published next month. It's a novel. And I don't think that I will be doing the interview circuit. I mean, nobody's ever heard of me or heard of this book. But I think I would be scared to death.
Well,
to be interviewed by someone, because I'm not sure, because the focus is on me.
Yeah.
Not on the person asking the dumb questions.
Not only is the focus on you, but, I mean, I don't have my word processor here, and I don't get the questions in advance. I don't get a chance, you know, to revise, except conversationally, the way everybody does when they talk if they want to. But someone told me once that John Updike thinks so fast that when he's asked a question by, you know, a reporter on the radio, he just thinks for a very short number of seconds, and then the answer comes out in well-formed sentences and in paragraphs, and he doesn't have to revise while he's talking. He doesn't have to take things back. But anyway, the person who does the writing, which is the person that you really had in mind to invite, actually can't be here because he only exists in a room, you know, behind a closed door. If there's too much noise outside behind a closed door, the radio playing. And the guy who's here is just the ordinary, you know, person on the street. I mean, he's like a cousin or second cousin to the guy who wrote the book, and he really doesn't know quite what to do or say. He's got to represent the book, and he's got to respond to you and to the occasion, and it's fun. I mean, don't get me wrong, and it's exciting. I would like to become so good at it that I would be referred to, you know, as the best the best interview going.
Well, I can tell you a little story about John Updike. I think he would probably disagree with you. I did an interview with him shortly after he had been on the CBS Morning News. What's the name of that woman who's on 60 Minutes with the blonde hair? I can't think of her name. She's one of the correspondents in 60 Minutes, but I can't.
Sawyer?
No, Diane Sawyer. I don't know, Janice, you might have been with John that day. He was promoting The Witches of Eastwick, and he stutters a little bit, too, and he was telling me, I asked how things went on the CBS Morning News, and he said, well, it went all right, except this woman asked me a question, and she said, what do men want from women? Well, he was completely unprepared for that, and it seemed to be dropped out of the bolt.
It depends on the time of day.
And he said he couldn't think of anything to answer. I know he managed something, but I wouldn't have known what to say.
You say it depends on the time of day.
Oh, that's not bad. Well, let's, we're wasting some time. I think we ought to talk about you a little bit. I was a little disturbed at some of the material that Knauss sent over. There were big, bold letters saying, the genius, and this sort of thing. Now, obviously, that would make anyone feel good to be described as a genius, but it also would, it would seem to me, put you in a very awkward position if it turns out in the long run that you aren't, because it's very difficult to tell one's genius. But how do you feel about people describing yourself in this way?
Well, first of all, it has been a long run. I mean, the stories come from a period of 30 years. And I'm not exactly young. I mean, when I was young, and I was called a genius for other reasons, not for my writing, because of a test score, let's say, or an accident that happened in freshman chemistry in college. Then it was a little nerve-wracking because it does suggest something that you have to do in the future, a level of citizenship or of accomplishment that you have to live up to. I mean, something that's been given to you, and that's a great privilege, and that you then somehow, despite the fact that it's yours, you then have to earn. But now, if somebody says it, I think it's a term that applies to, obviously not to me. They didn't test me or anything like that. They don't, even after the 3.5 or 4 weeks of interviews for the story that wound up with that remark, you know, with that epithet on the cover. What that is an American way of obliquely describing the book. It's a way of saying, I like the book in this particular fashion. But we don't have a critical culture. We don't even have a class. We don't really have an intelligentsia or an intellectual class or even an intellectual subclass. So we don't divide books into, so far as I can see, into high culture and middle culture and low culture. If we did, we wouldn't really be convinced by our own categories. So if you like a book in a certain way, you say, well, the writer is a genius. And I'm perfectly willing to accept the term as a term of praise and in the way that it's meant.
No doubt, it's terribly flattering, but it would seem to me that for most people it would be a burden very difficult to carry. Well, however, it looks as though you're carrying it very well.
Let's take another form of it. Let's say that somebody says to you after playing 50 or 60 of these tapes, that you're a genius at this format. There's no problem. They're discussing the work that you've accomplished.
Well, then they're not using the term carefully or accurately enough.
They're using it in the American sense.
It's an exaggeration.
Well, it refers to a level of accomplishment that's not quite ordinary, and it usually has to do with not being in it for the money. I got a funny letter, comic letter, from a guy named Michael Arlen, who's a good writer. And he'd gone to the trouble of getting an envelope and having it so it said Donald Trump on the flap. It began, Dear Harold, the last person to be called a genius on a New York Magazine cover was me. What kind of real estate genius are you? I mean, do you build itty-bitty houses on tracts of land outside? But anyway, it went on like that. But genius, in the American usage, simply refers to something over and beyond a certain level. I mean, the stories aren't written for money. They're not written for direct or immediate popularity. And I think it really is a generic term, like giraffe or... Look, if somebody cooks you a really good meal, you're inclined to... But over and beyond any cultural necessity for that meal existing the way it is, then you say, well, the cook's a genius.
Well, I go back to my previous statement, that is the term is being used much too loosely, but I'm not saying it doesn't necessarily apply in your case. And indeed, using the rather casual usage of the term genius, there is an element of genius in many of these stories. I mean, they're moving and they're touching, and many of them make you want to cry, and many of them make you want to become angry. So you do have that ability. There's no question about that. And in that sense, I guess I could go along with that term. It's just that it would seem to me that having that word over one's head would be a burden that you would have to live up to. I mean, not you, but in a generic sense, all of us would have to live up to.
But let's put it again, between the guy who writes, you know, the guy who appears in public. I mean, if you say that Marlon Brando is a genius, and a lot of people have, and do, and would, right? And a lot of other people would agree. There are two problems. One is which movie roles to take, right, if you're a genius. Well, I'm saying it in quotes. And how do you behave in public if you're a genius? And Brando worked out, you know, his particular pattern, and he drives people crazy the way he does it, right? But in my case, I mean, I'm not young. Because it's not going to change. You can call me a genius. A lot of people call me. It's not going to change anything. It's not going to enlarge my income or change my work habits or enlarge the number of readers particularly. It's simply a way of describing an effect of the stories, which Americans use that method rather than talking about the stories themselves. Right?
You are a staff writer at The New Yorker, aren't you?
Yeah.
That gives you a base, doesn't it? A medical
insurance? Yeah, but I've only been a staff writer for 2 years.
Uh-huh. How does one make a living writing the kind of literary stories
you
that
don't.
You write? Why do you do it? Why aren't you out being a chemist or a real estate salesperson or something like that?
Because I'm a genius. I mean, like Orson Welles was called a genius. Trump. I can't think of who. You know, Joe DiMaggio was a genius.
Truman Capote.
Well, I'm not sure he was called that so much as he called himself that.
Some people called him an unfulfilled genius, whatever that meant.
But this wasn't me reaching, you know, for a role or for hype. And I was figured that the work I could do, the work that I could do, might be of interest, you know, and eventually of importance. But it was a rather odd speculation to make of one's life. But I found out fairly early that if the work I did was economically sensible, that is, if I limited myself to a certain number of months to do a story or whatever, I could do that, but the work was of a certain order. And I still actually, in each section of the novel or in each of these stories, there's an earlier version of it which is commercially feasible. And when I get to that point, then I sort of, I partly relax and I partly tense up, and then the real writing begins. That is, I like the kind of writing which is unnecessary, which comes after the commercial or feasible, you know, practical level. Because it's almost like, well, you know, undiluted play. The circumstances then are really kind of favorable for performance, but not in practical terms. And anything you do in this world, probably, but certainly in the United States, you're going to have to pay for it one way or the other. And I get a certain kick out of doing that, but then I have to do without money, which is not always so amusing.
The stories in in an almost classical mode, are these stories from your long-running novel? I say long-running, I've heard so much about it, hasn't appeared, but these stories are in the book, is that correct? I mean, in the novel?
Two of the stories here, one called S.L. and the last one called Angel, are in the novel. But the others are taken from material that I was working on for the novel when I had to have money or when I just got lonely and wanted, you know, to exist in the public as some kind of citizen. And then I get changed around, and I work closely with editors.
Mm-hmm.
And they become, I keep calling it like commercially feasible, but I don't know, they became publishable within a magazine framework. And everything here was published. The only one that never got into a magazine at all was Angel, but it was published in a limited edition by the Jewish Publication Society.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the novel, A Party of Animals.
Yeah.
Tell me about this book. And all of the material, there's so many references to it, and it's obviously your life's work.
Well, it wasn't meant to be. It's just that it turned out to be a lot harder than I thought, and longer. But also, the way I write, which is again, something I wanted to do. It turned out not to be commercially feasible. I probably could have printed parts of the long novel. I mean, I was ready to print parts of the novel, but there wasn't anybody who wanted to print them. I mean, they thought the writing was a little too strange, or too strained, or too difficult for readers, or whatever. Now it's possible that it's the publicity or the hype or whatever, the talk that's built up, makes it possible to print it. But it's a serious attempt to write a novel that would be somewhat divorced from European cultural traditions and would exist in an American framework more thoroughly than other novels had. You always have to have something like that, you know, to kind of drive you along. I mean, some sort of public-spirited purpose. And it would have the effect that you say some of these stories had on you. That is, that in spite of writing about specific people and specific events, the stuff would still be recognizably emotional, you know, and intellectually interesting to people who had, you know, different kinds of lives, different kinds of experience. It's an attempt to find a public literary language.
But you delivered your manuscript to Farrar, Straus & Giroux some years ago. Why didn't they publish it?
I never delivered the manuscript. That was a public relations release. They asked to see part of the manuscript, and I showed it to them, and in various stages of being worked on. And the parts I liked, they didn't particularly like. And the parts that they liked, they only liked partly, and they wanted to change around and to edit. And I've always been a reasonable, lovable, temperate, you know, just adorable human being.
I can see that.
I said, well, sure. You know, show me, 100-150 pages of how you think it should be done. And they showed it to me. And it sounded like everybody else's novel. It was a good book, their way. It just wasn't mine. But I never showed them. No one has seen the novel. The one who's seen most of it is my wife.
So your manuscript is still at home, being worked on.
It remains to be put together. There's not a lot of work to be done.
How big is it?
Well, it depends on how you calculate. Sometimes isn't that much typed on one page, so I say it's anywhere from 3,000 to 6,000 pages, but the book I'm going to bring out next year will be between 800 and 1,000 pages. But manuscript pages aren't the same as book pages. I mean, the book wouldn't be that long if I did it all in one go, which I'm not going to do.
It does seem to me that there is a trend, especially among experienced writers, to write a masterpiece that is enormous. Everyone from James Dickey to James Clavell and their later books are that thick. And I just wonder sometimes about that. It makes a major demand of a reader to pick up a big book like that. It is a commitment that the reader must make to a large book, which perhaps is why mysteries are so popular. They're not 200 pages.
Oh, mysteries are good. P.D. James is 500 to 600 pages.
Yes.
Le Carré is really up there now, 700 pages.
Yeah, there are some exceptions.
The thing is that the world has gotten so complicated. But it takes a lot of time to present characters and situations, settings, things like that. That takes up a lot of room. Then America itself is so indescribable. I mean, it's so various, and there's so many facets. Again, you know, like social class. European social classes are relatively simple. In the United States, I mean, your mother is one class, your father's another, your four grandparents were probably from four different social classes, and you yourself, in the course of your life, passed through maybe seven or eight social classes. I mean, one time you have no money, another time you do have some, and before college you're one thing, and after college you're another. You go to graduate school, you're a third. You know what I mean? And by the time you try to get that into a book and into characters and into even into the sort of symbolic representation of the postmodernists. I mean, their books were getting longer and longer too, and then postmodernism suddenly exploded because the structures weren't in a sense legitimate for that kind of length. That's one part of it. The other part of it is simply the tradition of the epic. That is, you can't cover. A dream may only take 30, 40, 90 seconds of actual time, but they often tend to have an epic structure. And the epic structure is almost the basic storytelling structure. So let's say that this is going to be a three-hour program. And then you could ask me, what's it like now, after 35 years, say, to drive from Boston to St. Louis? And what changes do you see? That's actually, you know, an hour and a half answer, you know, talking back and forth. That's how complicated things are, but it's also because the mind structures haven't really adjusted to, say, modern scheduling. For instance, you'll get a probably—I don't know if this is actually true or not—but I would imagine you get higher ratings for a successful miniseries than you ever would for a single program, simply because the mind needs that kind of mass of data to respond to before it's really comfortable with the story, before it believes, before it'll suspend disbelief, before it'll care. But another way, you may be drawn to somebody on a first meeting, you know, or somebody you talk to on an airplane, and you can have a very sincere conversation, but it's nothing like the depth you can reach when you've known somebody for 5 or 6 years, and you settle down to talk, and you practice that, your experience of talking to that person. Well, with a book, a long book, there's a biography that's just come out of George Bernard Shaw by Michael Holroyd. And the first 100 pages strike me as being so clumsy and strained, but they lay out something. And then the second 100 pages are better. And then from there to the end of the book, it's just an amazing delight to read. But by then I've caught on to Holroyd, and Holroyd has caught on to Shaw a little bit. And there's this thing that gets going, but it takes a while. And reading is not, in modern terms, all that practical. It's not like listening to the radio or watching television. But again, even on television, a good television show, one that gets huge ratings, will take longer to look at than it takes to read a long book.
About the work itself, many of the stories in your collection deal with childhood images, and these are really sharp and vivid. And I was thinking as I was reading some of these stories that as you wrote of these childhood experiences, as you get older, they must become more vivid. It seems to me that as a child, I can look back and I took a lot of the things that happened to me as a child for granted. But over a period of many years, now as a mature adult, I'm looking back and I can see with great vividness what happened. Is this accurate? Is this what has happened to you?
No, but I think you're bringing together two separate things. Childhood itself, if you take the trouble, which I really don't recommend, to dig through, you know, the practical way we use memory is obviously designed by nature and cultural practice, and it's very useful. If you get past that to an actual memory, childhood was extraordinarily vivid. I think what happens to many of us, the second part of what you say, is that as we get older, we become a lot more patient with memory just for the sake of memory. And we give ourselves more time to remember. But there's still another part of that, which is that the mind works in a number of ways. But one way you can divide it up is into those things that lead to prediction, that is, which have to do with the future, and then present tense awareness, you know, like you and me looking at each other now. But something else is known through memory. But that's called cognition as well as memory. Put another way, if you're playing basketball, for instance, within 30 or 40 seconds, you're remembering the game in a kind of way. That's how you learn to play against the other players or whatever. So when we get older, unless we're broken, you know, by drugs or experience or ill health or something, ill health sometimes actually helps cognition, but as we get older, we get smarter. And you want to remember childhood, you do it in this cleverer fashion where some of the vividness does come back. That's what I think happens.
And yet, childhood, of course, is a very traumatic period because all of our first glimpses of life and experience come in childhood. The same, a similar incident could happen to you or me now that happened to us when we were 5, and it wouldn't have the same meaning or depth.
No, but if you're writing about childhood and something happens to you, it suddenly has to say, I mean, you lose some of your defenses. I mean, one of the reasons for holding back from publication when you're writing certain things is that you're in no shape really to leave the house. Then you may notice, for instance, that in this collection, with the exception of SL, there's a rather astonishing lack of stuff about grown men and grown men dealing with other grown men. There's a short episode at the beginning of Largely an Oral History, and then there's Wiley in bed with Aura in Innocence, and there's SL, but it's mostly about women and children with grown men shaping and holding up the world in which these people exist. I mean, the grown men exist as these tremendous powers and sources of reference, but they don't really appear in the stories as often as women do or as children do. And there are two reasons for that. One is that there's a lot of years in the United States when writing about women and children simply was, because as I said, these were all done for publication, these stories, and it was conceivable that that material could be shaped for that sort of publication, whereas men's lives really couldn't, except sometimes in the form of war stories, and I don't have any of those. I have some in the novel. There's one character who talks about his war experiences, but Wiley himself doesn't experience war directly. The thing about men dealing with men, that there is nothing, so far as I know, in American literary culture. I mean, there's nothing in Whitman, except the men being friendly, nothing in Eliot. And in Hemingway, you've got them either, you know, boxing or getting drunk together, but not trying to earn a living side by side, you know, maintaining a rivalry and a friendship at the same time. But the complex way that we live as men in this society, that still remains it's not here. And I think, though, that in those sections, the vividness is a little bit beyond public acceptance. That is, I'm experienced enough now after 4 days in giving an interview that I don't come out with the initial feeling that your questions arouse. You know, I wait a beat and I get a second more bearable feeling. But if you and I put the microphones aside and start to talk about books and envy and, you know, money and CBS and one thing and another, it's just as vivid as childhood, but it's much more violent because it's inflected by the enormous, comparatively enormous power we have as men compared to the power we had as children. Very little that we do as men is actually based on seduction. Whereas as a child, so much is that when you write about childhood, you have this advantage of dealing in seductive material that the reader can get along with. I've gone on too long, but you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Well, I have to give that some thought. I'm going to have to go back over the tape and listen to that. I'm a little puzzled about it, but I don't want to prolong. There's a couple of questions I did want to ask you. With regard to your novel, can you forecast when you are? Do you have a date in mind when you think you'll finish?
Yeah. There'll be a volume in work, I mean, at the publishers and in the process of being published within 4 to 6 months. Unless so many people throw tomatoes at me over this book that it, you know, becomes unwise to publish, in which case I'll probably print it up and make copies on a Xerox machine and circulate it to Janice and
spread a blanket over on Broadway and sell your own copies. No, that's not going to happen. People are not going to throw tomatoes at you. This book has been highly praised by most of the reviewers, not all, but most of the reviews that I've seen. But the thing that I wonder about, are you scared with regard to this novel? I mean, you've put so much into this, so much seems to be resting in terms of
this is what I was trying to say about being a man in this society. How much of your waking day are you scared? And I'm scared when I open a magazine. I'm scared that I'll be in it. I'm scared that I won't be in it. I'm scared of what other writers are. You know, there's a certain kind of American masculine life is sort of like open combat, about 16 waking hours. You have this tremendous political and economic freedom, but at the same time, everybody else does too. I mean, nothing is settled in advance, you know? So I'm scared like every other working man, but then I have a couple of advantages. I can generate much more tension and be even crazier with fear than you can be because no one's watching me when I work. if I actually get to the point where I can't breathe because I'm so tense when I write, I can just stop. You can't do that. I mean, you're on a sort of 9-to-5. I don't mean you're on a 9-to-5, but you're on some sort of equivalent thing because you're a public person. As far as publishing the book and being scared of what people are going to say, about, I don't know, about 3 days, I guess, before the galleys arrived at Knopf, I just stopped sleeping totally. There was just, and part of me doesn't care. You know, I've done the work, and then people can say what they like, but the tension, and all I could think of was that, again, as a man, I've been trained, you know, beyond any possibility of my own, doing the training of trying to carry out a contract. And I was afraid that the stories would turn out to be so bad, or that they would be so difficult, or whatever, that everybody who'd been connected with was going to be embarrassed. I just failed everybody. And then it turned out that it was going to be the usual American situation. Some would like it and some wouldn't, or whatever. The tension then lifted to the point where it was just ordinary animal fear, or, you know, just the ordinary kind. Now, the novel's going to be somewhat less fearful, you know, than this was. This was after more or less 30 years of silence. This was really scary.
This little book that I wrote, it took me 3 or 4 years to write it, but there wasn't much of
it. Well, it's not so little if it took 3 or 4
No, years. Well, I had to do it on weekends and holidays and vacations and nights and overnights and so forth. But it still didn't have that much invested in it. So if it fails, I'm sorry. It will embarrass me a little bit that I didn't do it because they didn't like it. But in your case, with this book, where you put everything into it over all of these years, it would seem to me traumatic if you reach the point where somebody says, hey, this book just doesn't work. We don't like it, period. I mean, in other words, the investment, the intellectual investment and the time that you have put into it is much more than the average writer has put into his work.
Yeah, but it was conscious, and knowing that every other American man of my generation has had to gamble one way or another. You buy this real estate or you go into this career. I remember, you know, trying to calculate in college, you know, what were the coming fields. Oil was a good bet. Television was a good bet. Newspaper journalism didn't look like such a good bet. You just do that. If there's almost no way the novel can be a total bust. I mean, I've shown parts of it to 5 or 6 people, so I know that parts of it are of value to somebody, right? What it would be, I mean, the horror would be to fail, you know, the publisher, to fail the people who'd liked the earlier work and then who didn't like the direction I'd gone in. It would be a terrible embarrassment, but it wouldn't necessarily wreck my life. It's not like I haven't been ignored in my life. I mean, and I've never had to starve. I mean, to be without money is again, it's embarrassing and humiliating, and it, you know, feels lousy. It feels like crap, you know, when you're an American, because you can't explain it to your family and friends. But it's not the same as starving to death or you know, cutting off your ear and going mad.
I shouldn't have really raised that, because the book is not going to fail. Based on the stories that I've read, you have a command of the language, and you do have a deep passion for people, for life. And I know this must be reflected into this novel, which I haven't read.
Exactly, yeah.
So, it's not as though untested,
yeah,
or untried.
So it can be disappointing, and it can be not worth the time, but I'm geared for that. I mean, what do you think happens to Sims or Parcells after a bad season? I mean, can't be helped. That's part. You gamble.
Who are Sims and Parcells? What do they write?
They write. I was complaining to a woman named Veronica Gang about Dwight Gooden's salary. You know, I mean, here he is. He's tremendously young. And he gets $1 million a year. And here I am, tremendously old, and I get, you know, 4 packs of bubble gum a year. And she said, yeah, Harold, but look, he goes out on a regular schedule, and he gives this audience exaltation on a regular basis. At the same time, when he fails, he fails. And she didn't say that, but I'm going on. But, you know, when he fails, he fails. And there's no reason why I can't be like that on a lifetime basis.
Well, Harold Brodkey, I'd love to be able to continue talking. I have a lot of other questions to ask you, but These are wonderful stories, and anybody who buys this book and gets immersed in these stories, I know they'll like them. Stories in an almost classical mode by Harold Bartke. Very nice. Thank you very much.